Welcome everybody. Let's give a welcome to Jayesh. He's talking about data modeling for IoT. Okay.
Thank you, Martin. Hello, welcome everyone. I know it's beautiful out there. You know, it's so painful to be in this closed room. Thanks for coming. I'm Jayesh from Conversant. We have nothing to do with IoT or vehicles. We are in the ad tech business, you know, so we do real-time bidding for ads. You know, that's our business. And at my company, I am dealing with building systems like Hadoop, Kafka, Spark, Cassandra, Flume, monitoring them, keeping keeping those systems healthy and all those things. And for the past 2 weeks, I've been moved to a development kind of role. So that's what I'm doing. And that's what kind of led me to thinking about data modeling. Of course, my transition was being talked about, or I was looking into it for over 6 months, and that's when I put in the proposal for this talk. All right, so coming back to our talk, data modeling for IoT. So why am I talking about this, and why are you here? Well, first thing, I think it's the next wave after social media. We have seen so many things around social media. You have Facebook, Twitter, and I don't know what else is out there. But you know, you're looking at kind of creating graphs, trying to build things around that. And the data modeling for that has been really being well discussed out there. IoT, although it's the next wave, there is less clarity around as to what IoT is and so on. So data modeling is always a very specific use case for everybody. So you might have Raspberry Pis, those are IoTs. You might have Samsung TVs, they are IoTs. Apple TVs or your PlayStation, they are all kind of IoTs. Now, but they all have their own use cases. So it's not very, we don't have a cookie cutter for data modeling for IoT. Second, just like any other big data system, it's got good challenges for volume, velocity, and variety. I believe that's the term that came out for big data definition. You know, like what is big data? You have volume, variety, and velocity. Okay. And as I said before, if we find a good data model practice for IoT, we can use that even for other big data models. I mean, big data applications. So that's my kind of driving factor. So as part of the talk, it'll be in three sections. In the first part, I will describe my application. What do I mean by IoT? And what am I talking about? That's one. The second part, we'll discuss the data model for that application. And then in the last part, I'll just, because I've been building systems, I have an affinity for how will the system look like as a big picture. So I discussed something about the architecture. Okay. Feel free to ask me questions. If they are short, if the answer is short, I'll answer it right away. If it needs more time or discussion, we can take it offline and can kind of then talk later. Okay. All right. Sample application. So I'll be taking an application related to intelligent vehicles. I mean, there are many terms for that: intelligent vehicles, connected vehicles, self-driving vehicles, automated vehicles. But I think intelligent vehicle is a better term. And when you talk about those kind of vehicles, they have three different things that they talk to. So there's vehicle-to-vehicle communication. They can talk to each other. In fact, there are cars now that talk to each other. Then vehicles talk with the internet or with the cloud. It could be a private cloud, but they talk to the cloud. And they can also talk to roadside kind of, roadside devices or your road signals and so on. And that's coming. I mean, those things are being developed. So you have vehicle to vehicle, vehicle to cloud, and vehicle to infrastructure. And anytime any talk happens, I would refer to that as an event. You know, like anytime we have a communication, I will refer to that as an event. And this is that will be the basis for our sample application. And specifically, I'll be focusing on the vehicle to infrastructure communication. They all may have their own variances, but I'll be focusing on the vehicle to infrastructure. Some assumptions first. Let's assume you have a billion vehicles. It would be hard to imagine a billion vehicles in a country or so, but at least let's assume that we have a billion vehicles in the worst case scenario. We have about 500 events per vehicle. And again, I've given some assumptions as to why, how we can have about 500 events per vehicle per day. And given that, we can arrive to about 500 billion events per day that we are dealing with, right? I mean, that's trivial math. And you'd say, hey, isn't that too high? Is it possible? Is it too, whatever? It's high, but it's doable. And today, in our company, we process between 150 to 190 billion log lines a day in a single Kafka cluster. And we're getting those events from across US and Europe. So we have experience. It's doable. Everybody does it. I think Netflix transmits about over a trillion events across multiple Kafka clusters. So it is a doable thing. Some assumptions on the size, and assuming that we have Cassandra as our backend data store, it can be anything. It could be HBase or whatever you prefer. But for this talk, I'll be using Cassandra as my backend data store. And again, making some assumptions on how data will flow. It will be a streaming application, and we'll use streaming for both ingestion, processing, and ETL. I'll give more details on that. And then there could be a potential of ad hoc, kind of analysis of your data. And the key thing is avoiding indexes. With such a large volume, 500 billion events a day, and maybe you're storing data for a couple of days or months or whatever your retention period be, building viable indexes or practical indexes is not easy, maintaining them. So the goal of this data model is to avoid indexes. Okay. All right. So that's how I'm thinking about the application. You have the infrastructure network. You have some receiver that gets data from the infrastructure, pushes it into Kafka. You have some kind of stream processing that reads from Kafka, that will do some data cleansing and whatever it needs to do. Get the data, then process data, push it into another Kafka Kafka system or so. And from there, you'll have systems that will write data to Cassandra. And you'll have the systems streaming and doing some analytics on that and pushing it downstream. So now that's the big picture that I'll be addressing at the end of the talk as to how we can implement this architecture. Any questions so far? Okay. So that's what I would refer to the ingestion pipeline. That's the data storage section, and that's the downstream processing. Okay. All right. I'll also make some assumptions on what is needed for the application. We need low latency writes and reads. At this volume, you cannot take your data ingestion to take more than a day for a day's worth of data. You have to be writing it instantaneously. So that's a key requirement. And if you have indexes, this will be very hard to achieve. Okay. More assumptions on the queries. So when I have the data in the system, I need to be able to query the data in a variety of ways. First, I want to see all the events by a vehicle. I want to be able to do that. I want to be able to query events by an infrastructure. So for example, if you have the Biscayne Road and you have some signal traffic there, or some traffic signal there, you're going to see all the events that happen, say, between 4 and 7 p.m. Get me all the data. So So you should be able to run those queries very easily and very efficiently. And the third one is I want to see the events for the downtown of Miami. Show me all the events that happen, because I want to show them on a graph to show the traffic, you know, the traffic pattern. So you could have those kind of queries in the system. And again, some more assumptions on what would be a realistic, latency kind of expectations. You know, you could have between 100 to 100,000 rows, and corresponding kind of response time. Okay. With this in mind, here's an example of how you may go around doing your data model. It resembles a data warehouse kind of star schema. If you see, you have the events in between. That's like a fact table. When you think about data warehouse, that's a fact table. The vehicle, time, road segment, and infrastructure, they are the dimensions. So it's mirroring more of a data warehouse kind of data model. And a road segment could be part of a region. So kind of also showing that kind of hierarchy of your dimension. Yeah, I haven't focused on. I mean, if you are coming from a data warehouse background, I haven't focused on whether they are slowly changing dimensions or just a snapshot dimension. That's more refinement of the data model. I won't focus on that. But as I was saying before, this data model can be applied to a variety of things. So, for example, the same data model you can apply it to search and advertising. You can have an event, cookies, people, and so on. Okay. Or to social networks. Right. So if we can solve it for one kind of application, it's not difficult to apply it to other areas. Okay. All right. So now let's focus on the actual data model. For this data, the idea for this data model came to me from the way how a Unix inode is kind of defined. Unix was conceived sometime in 1971, and at that time they were thinking of petabytes and petabytes of data, where your files were no bigger than a few hundred kilobytes. So even since at that time, they had the capability to address large volumes. And how did they do that? So the way it was done is that a file would have an inode, which is the metadata for the file, and that inode would have 13 pointers to data. The first 10, 1 to 10, would be pointers to data blocks. Now the size of the data block could vary. Initially they started with half a kilobyte data blocks, then they went to 1K and so on. So the size of the data block doesn't matter, but you had a data block. So first 10 would be direct pointers, and that would serve most of the files that were in use at that time. Most of the files, they would be under 10K. So you would be using 10 pointers and you'd be done. If you needed to put more data in your file, you would have an indirect pointer. That pointer was a pointer to a pointer of data blocks. As I've shown there. Then the next indirect would be a pointer to a pointer, which was a pointer to data blocks. So that's how they did the indirection. But with this scheme, you could address a file from under a kilobyte to a petabyte. Right, so that's the model I'll be kind of using for my data model. As far as Cassandra goes, how many of you are familiar with Cassandra? Oh, wow. Okay. So Cassandra is just a big data store. In the early days, it was a schema-less system. Now you have to predefine your schema for tables. So you define tables in your Cassandra data store. The data types could be primitives, collections, or user-defined types. And by primitives, I mean int and long, I mean int, long, and so on. And the collections are more like maps. So you have a field that is logically a single field, but has got key value pairs in that. So that's a map. Okay. Every table has a primary key, just like any other database. And then you can have collections of tables which are grouped together into a key space. And like any other database, accessing your data by primary key is very fast. It's very fast because there is a key cache, there is a Bloom filter, and then you have indexes on your data that is at the Cassandra SS table or the Cassandra file level at a very low level. So the accessing data is very fast. It's very low latency. Okay. So armed with that, let's move on to the actual data model. Okay. Let's assume that our data looks something like this. The event data has an ID. The data has a timestamp, infrastructure ID, vehicle ID, speed, direction, and so on. So that's what, and I would guess that events contain, you know, or the event data contains. Vehicle data, you know, has a make, model, VIN, and so on. Infrastructure would have something similar. So basically, each of those data types has an ID and some fields to store the data. Now, given this, there are many ways to slice and dice or to store this data. One example could be you have one field, or you have one column per field. So you have the ID, the timestamp, vehicle ID, infrastructure ID, and so on. They are all stored in a single column. That's one way to store your data, right? Like, you know, you have a field. You have a column per field. Okay, that's the traditional way of doing things. There is another way whereby you take now the if you take the first option, it's too many interactions happening at the data store level. You know, like every field is stored separately, so there's more more fields created in Cassandra and so on in your application. So you might say, hey, let me use a single blob as my data. So you store the whole, all your fields. You would either, you would serialize them into either some kind of Avro, protobuf, whatever you need, some kind of format, and store your data. So that's the other way of storing your data, right? And there's also one more way. The other way is to store data in a collection. So you have the ID and the data, and the data is actually a map column, and that map has got key value pairs for the field, for the field name and the field value. So timestamp is a field name, and you have the value of the timestamp in your table. This allows you to have a very flexible data model. So in the future, if you want to add more fields or remove fields or discontinue using fields, you don't have to do any schema changes. You know, that's the gist behind going for this approach. The only caveat is that when you define your map, you have the type of the map, the key value pair is predefined. So you cannot change. You cannot have the field to be the field value to be a string for one kind, int for another kind. It has to be the same kind. That's the only caveat that is that's out there. But I'm sure we can overcome that. You can make it into a binary. So you can always serialize your string, your int, and whatever into a binary. So you can store both textual and non-textual information in your fields. So that's what we will, or I'm. I will use going forward. Okay. All right. So we will use that approach for all the data, both for the what I would say the fact data as well as the dimension data. Okay. So as I said before,
we need to satisfy queries whereby, given a vehicle, I want to see all the events, or given an infrastructure, I want to see all its event. And it could be by a time, you know, saying, show me all the vehicle events between 9 a.m. to 4 p.m. Show me all the event data. So you need to be able to drive into your events from any of those things. So for that, what I'm proposing is to have a table that allows you that kind of navigation. So vehicle to event, infrastructure to event, and road segment to event. So rather than have an index or an index at the Cassandra level, I'm recommending or I'm proposing a table that allows that navigation, and I'll go into more details here. So you might say, what is the benefit of having a table versus an index? And because the table I have to maintain, or you have to maintain that table. I agree that maintenance is there, but as we will see next in the next slides, the tables are very purpose-driven to allow you that navigation. Okay. So let's look at the first one, vehicle event, which allows you to navigate from vehicle to events. Let's look at that. The table might look something like this. You have an ID. You have two columns, map data and set data. Map data, key value pairs of your data, where the key is the field name and the value is the value of that field. So if it's time, then the text would say time, and the value would be the timestamp.
All right. And the set data basically is just a collection of some values. Okay. So let's assume that, say, we have a vehicle that has some UUID and an event ID, and you want to store this.
How would I store that? So in that vehicle event table, which would be defined like that, I would create a row that says, this is my vehicle ID. And the set data would be kind of date and hour time, your date and hour portion of your timestamp. So 2017-06, 24-08. So the 8 a.m. on that date, 9 a.m. on that date. If there are any data created for that hour, we'll have an entry here. If you take your vehicle and you leave your home at 8:15, we'll create an entry here for 8 o'clock. Right. So every hour that vehicle is in motion and there's some data exchange, there'll be an entry created. Now, you might say, how big can this thing get? If you're just talking about, say, for a year's worth of data, you could potentially have, say, 365 times 24, or say 400 times 25. That's how many? 100,000? No, 10,000 events. So it's quite a bit of data in that set, but it's not too much. And there's also an assumption that you will not have your data for a long period in your data store. It could be maybe a year's worth of data or 2 years worth of data, not perpetually adding data there. Okay. Now, for that hour, whenever you create new event, for that hour, we will have another row in the same table where the key is the vehicle ID, which is kind of first part of the key, and there will be another part of the key that would be the hour. So for one full hour's worth of data, you would have one row. And that row, in the map data, you would have the timestamp as to when that thing happened, and a pointer to the actual event data. So see that 25B68 that points to the actual event data. So now you have a way. If you ask me, show me all the events for between say 8 and 4 p.m. I can go to this here, look for those, look for the entries for the hours, go to the hour, and I'll have the, all the list of the data that, that's out there.
So basically, it's a kind of pruning or filtering your data and going right to the keys that are kind of relevant to you. Once you have that, you can always go to the actual event data.
Now this navigation, I mean, if you are using Cassandra and say if you have Spark, this navigation is very trivial. In fact, I'll show at the end how it can be done.
Basically, you would be reading data from Cassandra, you would read this as your one row using, and you filter out the timestamp that you need, take those timestamps and kind of flatten the data out, go for the actual hourly data. Take that hourly data and then you can go to the actual events. So this navigation is made very easy by things by Cassandra and Spark. It's like they're custom made for each other basically to do this kind of navigation. Is the data model, I mean, is this clear? I think because this is a key thing for the data model. Does it make sense? So by focusing on the hour, you are completely pruning out everything else and just focusing on that hour. And then given that hour, you go into the hour key here, you can just get all the events for that hour and then scan through the actual events. So imagine if this was done by using a secondary or by some kind of an index, you know, index on your table, it would be very expensive at the Cassandra, from a Cassandra perspective. Let's look at another example. I think this will help you again. It's a similar concept. So this time we have an infrastructure, a vehicle, and an event ID. Right. So you will first create an entry for the infrastructure. I think the colors are not very easy to distinguish. But this one is a pointer to the infrastructure. And the same way you have a pointer for the hour.
Now, at that hour, what we have is a timestamp and the ID for a vehicle. If you do it this way, your data is now automatically sorted by time. You see, so if you want your events by time for the infrastructure, it's already automatically sorted because Cassandra guarantees ordering of your data.
And so for that, that green color ID, which is the vehicle ID, the time and the vehicle ID point to the actual event data, and then you have the actual event there. So if you want to do further filtering by vehicles or by time, you can do it by doing the right filtering on that map data, you know, map data column. Does it make sense? I mean, does it sink in? So let's look at the last one. This is a little bit, similar thing, I think, but a little bit more kind of, what I would say. Because you have a hierarchy of the infrastructure, there is some more depth there. So you have a region, you have a road segment, and you have the infrastructure. So you're saying, show me all the events for Miami downtown. And again, I don't know how you define your regions, but say you want to get all the events for Miami downtown. So you'll have the region, and that region, instead of having that map I have a set, it says that this region is made up of these road segments. So all the road segments in the Miami downtown area are there. And by road segment, I would say, either it's at the block level or whatever is appropriate for your city planning, you would have that, and you'd have a set of that data. If you want, you can also use a map whereby the key is the road segment and the value is the time when that road was added to the to your region, if you want to. Now that road segment points to
all the infrastructure IDs that compose that road segment. Just like the first one, we are saying this region is composed of road segments. Road segments are composed of infrastructure IDs.
And once you have that, you can always navigate down to the events by infrastructure. So there are already standards out there whereby you have, say, your traffic lights. They have intelligence in them, and they have transmitters and receivers, and they can talk to your vehicle. So I mean, they are already being proposed, and I think there are some experimental things out there, but you know, they are not really in full use out there. And I have pointers as to where you can find more information for the for those. Those things. Okay. All right. So, what we looked at was how, you know, the table structure, the data, how the data is organized. But if you do it as is, it's not very efficient. And for the volume that we have or we'll be looking at, you need to kind of really, you know, kind of squeeze out more performance out of it. So. Some thoughts or some recommendations we can. So if you look back, I had said level zero, level one. What I'm saying is, it might be even better to have each level in a table of its own. So the vehicle event table that we had, we have vehicle event level zero, level one. That way, you know, you really segregate your data. The reason behind this is that the smaller your data set, the easier it is for Cassandra to manage your tables, like compactions and all those. Those are quite intensive activities. And if you separate out into multiple tables, the compactions are well contained. So that's the reason behind splitting the tables. Also, when I in the examples, I had used UUIDs. And those UUIDs are, you know, they are alphanumeric. But you know, you can always make them into binary formats, so they are more compact. So like as is, it would be 32 bytes if you show them as ASCII. But if you make it into binary, you can compact that into 16 bytes. And where I had the UUID and time, it could be just a blob of binary bytes. And you could kind of concatenate, you know, the first 16 bytes as the UUID, the next 8 bytes as the as your date. So again, it makes it more compact. Bear in mind, every byte you save is 500 billion or 500, you know, will be replicated for the 500 billion events. So that means 500 gigabytes. So every byte saved is tremendous. So saving bytes is very critical here. Okay. Same thing for the column name. So ID is short enough as is. But for the map and the set, I wouldn't even use the word map. I would just say M and S. Again, you are saving bytes. Right. And let me go back here. So here, if you had seen, I had used time there, 2316, 732. Even that time, how to store it, you can make it more compact by using that time as the milliseconds for the day. So if you store that time as is, you will need a long. But if you make it into milliseconds for the day, it will be an int. So again, you are saving 4 bytes out there. And what you would have seen is that in the whole data model, I'm not doing any updates. Your data is immutable, number one, and number two, it is idempotent. So if you rewrite that event 10 times, it won't create any issues for you. You know, like both in the level zero, level one, as well as the event data, if you rewrite them, because say, you know, kind of you want to replay your data, you had a server crash and you're replaying your data, it won't cause any issues. So that's very important. And second, you can use Cassandra TTL to discard your data. Even better would be to have your data, your key spaces by time. So you might say, hey, I want to have one key space per day or one key space per week or by month, whatever you want, and store your data in specific key spaces. So when you switch your month, you can just drop the key space for the previous month. So again, that makes data cleansing, data aging very efficient. Efficiency is because at this scale, efficiency is very, very important. Storage, backups, whatever you do, it's very important. Okay. All right, so key takeaways. We try to have single column primary keys. I've had very, very bad experiences when I have partitions and I say, hey, I want a partition by time, so all my data for that time is in a single partition, but then that means all the data goes to a single server, and if I retrieve my data for that time period, I'm just getting it from a single server. So even if I have 400 servers in my cluster, for that query, I'm only banging one server and getting it from just one server. So that's not a good thing to do. You want to spread out your data. Second, short primary key and column names, again to save data. So even when doing a scan, if you had seen, I'm reading one row and that one row gives me all the keys, say for that hour. So that's how I'm saying by one access, I'm getting the keys for that hour. Okay, that's what I'm looking at. Range scan. So the way I have organized the data by the hour, that allows you to paginate your data. So for example, if somebody is browsing your data and they say, show me data from 9 a.m. to 4 p.m., you don't make the user wait for a long period for the data. Technically, reading that amount of data might take, say, 30 seconds or 50 seconds, but because you are paginating, you are giving them the perception of rapid response. So you paginate your data. And last thing is data immutability. You want to have your data to be not changing, not updated. That makes it very easy for the system. And finally, data purge. You can purge it by TTL or by having different key spaces. So that's end of part two. Part one, the application. Part two, data model. And part three, the architecture. So if you look on the extreme right, that's the application architecture we were thinking about. So given that, how would you design your system? Say we are doing a nationwide system and you want to get all the data from infrastructure across the country. One option is that this becomes, say for example, you have infrastructure or those road items across the roads, and they transmit the data from that place to a centralized system. Okay, so that's one way to do it. In this case, you have your receiver, Cassandra, and everything in just one central system, and the data is being transmitted over the network to that central system. So that's one way to design your system. So basically, data from remote places comes into a single location. That's doable, and we actually have this model for what we do for our ed pipeline. We transmit data from, we have one data center East Coast, one on the West Coast, and one in Europe, and we send data from there into Chicago. That's doable. The other option is that you have Cassandra that uses multi-data center approach. So you have Cassandra in four different places. They are all identical kind of systems. And we are using the Cassandra's power to have distributed systems. So data at each region is identical. Whatever data you get from this region goes into this data center or into this Cassandra area,
and the data then gets replicated to the other three areas. With this approach, you have real good redundancy of your data. You localize your data, but then you have got multiple copies of your data. And with Cassandra 3.0, you can actually say that over here, store with three replication, and over the, and in the other areas, store with two replication, and so on. So you can customize your replication if you want.
Or
you can even do this way, whereby you have that application localized to each region. So you have all data collection, processing, and ingestion happening at the region level. So that way, kind of, you know, they're all segregated. If you have a network outage, you know, those, the other systems are not impacted by that. And then you collect your data, you aggregate it or whatever you want, and send it to a centralized system. So, like for example, if you want
to have state level data collection and federal level kind of aggregation, and they're only interested in the main highways at the federal level, you can not transmit all the other events. You know, it'll make it more efficient. So that's one way to do it. Okay. And here are some references. So, like, you know, there's already some work being done in this area, like connected vehicles, connect, you know, the infrastructure, and so on. In fact, there is,
I think the third one, second and the third one, they have links of these things happening at an experimental level in certain areas of, I think it's in Atlanta or somewhere, they are having experiments going on as to how it will look like.
And from what I understand, BMW and Volvo, they already are making connected cars that talk to each other, and they send their data to a centralized system, you know, for traffic or whatever, but they are, it's already in works. And one last thing, so like, as I was saying before, how can, like I said, that if you read for those index tables, you have the set or a map that contains all the data, and you can kind of serialize it very easily. And here's an example in Scala, I show how you can do that. You know, so you have a key, the values are a set, and you define that as an iterator, and you have, you know, you'll need to define three different things. You know, two things, the has next and next, define those things, and, you know, say over here, I'm converting, so if I define a sequence where I have A, and the set contains A1, A2, A3, I want them to be A, A1, A2, and A and A3, so I can kind of, you know, do a flat map of that. This is how you would kind of, you know, read your data from Cassandra and kind of make it into individual rows for the event data. And this one then you could join to the actual event data set. So you can fatten your data out. Right. That's it. Any questions?
You mentioned that Cassandra was keeping something in order. What was that?
Yeah, so when you have a collection of your, you know, a collection column like a map, a set, or a list, it'll keep your map and set in the ordered date, you know, in the ordered format of the key. So, you know, say you have a key value pair in map, the data is ordered in the order of the keys, and for a set, I believe in the order of the values of the sets. So, you know, you are, you know, kind of, it's a benefit of that.
Is there a way to compress the data by maybe the underlying file system or something? Because still quite redundant, even though you try to use as a few bytes as possible.
So Cassandra does have inbuilt compression. It uses, correct me if I'm wrong, LZ4 compression. So it does compress the data. So, I mean, I think once you compress at that level, then the file system, you may not get more benefit.
Do you have any numbers how much you gain in your specific
example? I don't have any numbers, but I can make guesses, but I don't have any numbers. Any questions? Okay. All right, thank you.